Hey, Lily, I'm curious. Where do your best ideas come from? Mine always seem to come when I'm walking up the road on the way home, and then I'm desperately trying to make sure I don't forget them before I walk in the door.
I always get mine when I'm in the shower, and I always thought that was why businesses had showers at work. But then someone told me it was something to do with exercise.
Yeah, I think that might be it. But, you know, what if there was a better way? Gal Josephsberg is our guest today, and he's got a great overview on how to get inspired to generate new ideas and when to share them with the rest of your team.
Gal's got a ton of experience at companies like Guidewire, Oracle, Acton, Social Chorus, and Baynote, and also is a guest lecturer at General Assembly. If you need some inspiration on how to get inspired, then this episode is for you.
The Product Experience is part of the Mind the Product Network. Every week, we talk to the best product people from around the globe about how we improve our practice.
Aside from conferences in London, San Francisco, Singapore, Hamburg, and Manchester, there's also free product tanks in more than 185 cities, and there's probably one near you.
Find out about them on mindtheproduct.com, where you can also catch up on past episodes, videos from the conferences, read great articles, and learn about the training that we do.
Hi, Gal. Welcome to the Product Experience podcast. It's really great to have you here. And I'm really looking forward to talking about this topic, which is all about where good ideas come from. But before we get started on that, it would be ace to hear a bit more about how you got into product management and what you're doing these days.
Sure. Yeah. First of all, thank you for having me here. And so I got into product management originally sort of by accident. I was an engineer. I didn't like being an engineer that much because back then everything was waterfall. It was go back into a dark room and don't come out for 9 months until you're done with the release. And then we hired an excellent product manager into the first company that I was in out of college. And of course, me being the smart aleck engineer, I kept telling her like, why can't we do this? I can build it in a weekend. Why can't we do that? I can do this in a day if you let me. And so finally she said, hey, listen, if you think you can do this, I've got a job open. Why don't you come work for me? And you don't seem happy in engineering, so come try to do product management. I've been in product management ever since. I've done some other things on the side, like product marketing, UI, UX, biz dev, and even engineering management. But I've always loved product management. So I've been in product management ever since. I'm currently at a company called Guidewire. I'm the head of the platform product management team. Guidewire, it's the biggest company you've never heard of. We're a $1 billion a year company that is public. And nobody's ever heard of us because we make insurance software. And I run the platform team. So yeah, we're in a building next to SurveyMonkey, which is, I think, a tenth our size. And everybody is always like, hey, you guys are next to the SurveyMonkey building. Do you know any of those folks? They're bigger than you, right? I'm like, no, not really. So yeah, that's where I am. That's what I do.
And funnily enough, when we were talking just before we started recording, you said that you called yourself an engineer. You're like, hey, I'm an engineer. So you still consider yourself to be an engineer then?
That's a really good question, right? So yes, I still occasionally write code, but I will also be honest and say, you know, I've been doing product management as my focus for a long time. And so, I tell my engineers if they ever see a merge request from me, they should pay extra special attention to the code review. Because listen, engineering in general is a skill that you need to stay current on. And since I don't spend all day every day on it, I'm a little bit rusty. So I do still consider myself an engineer. I do still muck about in the code. But these days I hire good people to do the really hard engineering for me.
So I'm really curious about this topic because, you know, to find a good idea, I usually wait for the full moon. I make the appropriate offering. I dance around counterclockwise 3 times. And then if I'm lucky, I find a good idea the next day. But is that the right way of doing it? Is there a better way?
It's counterclockwise 3 times. No, that's a mistake you're making. It depends on what kind of ideas you're trying to come up with, right? And this is what I try to teach my product managers, especially the ones who are relatively new, that, listen, it's okay to make gradual evolutionary changes. And in fact, you know, the bread and butter of product management is gradual evolutionary changes, right? What small feature can I add? What small problem can I solve? But the question is, are you looking for those or are you looking for the truly big innovative changes? Because I think that's a very different process for both of them. And you need to be aware of what you're trying to do. And I think too many product managers go into product management thinking, ah, I'm going to be the next Steve Jobs and every week I'll invent a new iPhone. And I'm like, yeah, not so much. 99% of your time is going to be spent saying no to the horde of, you know, feature requests that are coming your way from all your stakeholders, and finding, you know, the few good ones to make evolutionary changes. Like big revolutionary changes, those are rare, and you probably don't need them every day. You need them once a year to sort of shape the vision for the year. So I don't know. That's just my philosophy on it. That I think you need to be aware of what kind of ideas you're looking for. Is it the evolutionary or the revolutionary?
Okay. So did your talk focus around the revolutionary changes, and when you're doing that kind of thinking, how you set the right scene for creating good ideas in that scenario?
Yes, typically, because I think these days the evolutionary changes are relatively well understood, right? You're going to have a lot of requests from people. You do small experiments. You know, this whole notion of delivering MVP and experimenting and being data-based, I think are relatively common for product managers. It's the how to come up with the big revolutionary things that are still difficult for many people. And so, yes, that's typically where my talks focus, because I feel like that's where people are looking for help.
I'm going to slightly off the beaten track on this one. Tell me about the last time you had a revolutionary idea, or someone on your team did.
Sure. So the last time I had a revolutionary idea, and this I think just goes to illustrate the point, was a few months ago, when we basically chucked the whole platform plan out the window and came up with a brand new one based on some other design principles that we wanted to do. And again, that's revolutionary because we had to start from scratch based on some new ideas. And by the way, what I do today is very platform related. So I don't know how many people are going to be interested in, hey, we've got a whole new way of using Kubernetes. that may not be everybody's idea of a fun Sunday afternoon discussion. But yeah, you know, it was months ago, and that's what I mean by it's not every day. It's the big revolutionary changes are things you, because I'd also point out that the big revolutionary changes are risky. It's the evolutionary stuff is nice and safe. That's where you spend most of your day to day on. You don't need big risky stuff unless something's going wrong, right? The big risky stuff is when you want to take a gamble. It's when you need to take a gamble. You don't do that very often.
Okay, so how do you set the right environment to generate good ideas then?
So first of all, in terms of environment, I always want to set up an environment for my team where failure is okay. And I say that because I just mentioned the fact that sort of the big revolutionary changes are risky. And risk means that you will occasionally fail. In fact, sometimes you'll fail a lot. And so the very first step to having an environment that is conducive to these big revolutionary changes is being okay with failure. And there's a lot of philosophy that goes around there about, you know, failing fast, learning from your failures, being data-driven. I won't belabor the point, but I just want to say that that's condition number one for good idea generation is people need to feel like they're going to be okay failing, whether that's failing when you generate the idea or whether that's failing 6 months later when you invested some resources into it. People need to know that failing is okay. If you're not failing, you're not taking risks.
Is it trickier for you to set that environment up within your team or to set that culture up in a wider space within the company?
It's typically the latter, setting that culture up within a wider space, right? Especially in the kind of companies that I work at, I typically work in big, you know, enterprise software companies, right? Where you don't have 100 million customers where, you know, if you do a little screw up, it's okay. We have 400 customers where if we screw one up, that's a $30 million contract down the drain. And so, you know, explaining to the rest of the company, especially people like the sales team and the services team that like, hey, we're going to experiment a little bit is scary. And you also need to explain that properly, right? You know, we're not going to experiment with exposing the customer's data, right? We have limits. We have sane boundaries about where we experiment. We have sane, you know, limits and scopes about where experiments can happen. But I do want them to understand like, hey, I'm going to try to release this feature and the feature may not work, in which case we'll pull it back and remove it. And they need to be okay with that. So yeah, it's definitely the latter, explaining it to the company as a whole.
Any tips on how to do that well?
The best way to do it is to show, right? Literally, like, instead of just giving them sort of an abstract process that you will follow, come up with your first idea and then literally show them how you will experiment with this, how you will do it safely, how you will make sure that customer impact is kept to an acceptable level, how you will find early adopters. Like, in an abstract, everything sounds scary, but when you actually show them, like, this is the first idea that we will be working with, this is the first customer that we will be talking with, here is what we're going to tell them, and hey, sales, I want you here with me to do it. That's a lot. It's a lot better. It's a lot less scary to people.
And you mentioned a few different methods that you can use to go about coming up with a good idea, or I guess as a way of generating inspiration, or I guess different approaches as well. And it would be great if you could kind of just walk us through the different methods that you've identified.
Sure. So let's differentiate between the revolutionary and the evolutionary, right? The evolutionary, the gradual changes, those are the easy ones. Those are the product manager asking themselves, hey, what's the problem that can solve here? You know, what's the feature that they're asking for and why? Those are great. Those are your bread and butter. I'm not knocking those at all, but that's not what we're talking about, right? We're talking about the big revolutionary stuff. So let's talk about a few methods here, right? The first and sort of easiest method is, you know, the how do I take a solution from one place and apply it in another? And this is why a lot of times you'll see startups with, you know, such novel concepts as, hey, I'm the Uber for garden equipment. Or I'm the Facebook for cat owners, because it's easy, right? I'm taking a solution that I already know works and applying it to something else. And a lot of times that's region, right? So I'm the Facebook for South America, or I'm the Uber for Russia. And it's, in some cases, it's a different industry. Those are actually interesting. What gets even more interesting for a product manager is picking out the individual strength of those. So don't just say Uber. It's I'm going to take Uber's crowdsourcing ability and apply it specifically to my area, right? Those are the interesting things that can sometimes get you a nice revolutionary change. So that's method number one. I'll pause there. Do you have any questions about that one? Should I describe all these methods sort of at a high level and we can dive into each one of them?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Yeah.
So method number one is the how do I apply something that already works to something where that thing is not applicable to yet. Method number two to me is the hybrid, right? And I had a wonderful teacher during my business school who basically said, you know, what do you get if you cross a snake with an SUV? Well, usually you get a very dead snake, but sometimes you get a really, really awesome idea for, you know, an SUV that recharges itself in the sun. And it's basically this hybrid model is just literally always ask yourself, hey, I'm looking at this thing right here. What are its strengths? What happens if I cross it with something else? What does a snake SUV hybrid look like? And I realize that sounds kind of dumb, right? Snake SUV, come on, this is ridiculous. But maybe those aren't the exact examples to look at. But at the end of the day, what I'm asking the product manager to do is just be open to what if I cross this and this? Just let your mind sort of explore what is that option and see what you end up with. And then the third the method that I like to talk about is the solution in search of a problem. And I realize most of the time we tell people, no, don't do that, right? Solutions without a problem are a bad thing. And that's because they are. 99% of the time, they really are a bad thing. But a solution in search of a problem, sometimes you just end up building something cool. And then you think to yourself, okay, where can I apply this, right? And I'll give you an example of each one of these, right? So that solution in search of a problem, this is AWS, right? They ended up with all this spare compute capacity. And then some clever product manager went, well, we got all this extra compute capacity because we overbuilt our data centers. I don't know. Where should we use this? Hey, we can rent it out to somebody else, right? And all of a sudden, AWS is born. So it's the solution in search of a problem. And again, I this is why I said it's you have to make sure that people feel okay to fail, because a lot of times when you just build a solution without knowing what the problem is, you're going to end up wasting resources, and you have to be okay with that. But those are the three methods that I like to ask my product managers to use. Like, just go through each one of these and just see where you end up with. And you'll write 100 things on the board and you'll rule out 90 of them already because they're dumb. That's okay. With the remaining 10, and sometimes all 10 are going to be bad, and sometimes you'll get one good idea out of it.
I think it's really interesting. And what I wonder is whether with each of those different methods, you would ever come up with a truly original idea. But then I was kind of thinking, well, maybe actually no idea is truly original.
Yes, it's a great philosophical discussion, right? Are any ideas truly original? We talk about Steve Jobs, for example, as the master of original ideas. But let's take a look at the iPhone, which is, you know, said to be his revolutionary idea, right? I mean, we already had cell phones, so that's not revolutionary. We already had the iPod, so that's not revolutionary. And in fact, we already had, if you recall, the Motorola Razr was a phone that could play music. That was before the iPhone. We had personal organizers and smartphones before the iPhone. We had, you know, the BlackBerry and the Palm. So what did Steve Jobs do? He came up, you know, and this is more the method number two. He's like, what if I cross all these things together and make them cool? You know, he had some awesome marketing, and he also had some really good UI design in terms of the touch interface, where he took sort of what is on the computer, the mouse. He said, hey, listen, the current interfaces for smartphones, the thumb wheel on the BlackBerry and the little pen on the Palm, just aren't good enough. Where can I find something that works well and apply it here? So I would argue he followed these same methodologies. And did he come up with that in a flash of vision? Did he wake up one morning and just yell out, oh my God, the iPhone, I see it in my head. Like, I don't know if any idea is truly original. I think if you practice these methods over and over, you will find yourself unconsciously applying them and unintentionally coming up with good ideas. But you still need to do that practice.
You've said the word you a lot. Who should be generating these ideas? Is it by yourself? Is this a team activity?
That really depends. I find this notion of we're going to go into a room and brainstorm to be somewhat artificial, right? And it just feels weird. Like, let's go into a room and brainstorm. I feel like most of these things, you can't push them to happen that artificially. And so I believe this is, you should be doing this on your own. You, the product manager, should be doing this on your own and then get together as a team to discuss the ideas. I try to make it a practice every morning, write down two ideas. And by the way, the 99% of them, you know, the next day when I look at them, I'm like, oh my God, this is garbage. What was I ever thinking? But, you know, occasionally I come up with a good one. And I feel like if every product manager has that practice of just every day, write an idea or two based on one of these methodologies, it gets you in the practice of coming up with new ideas. And like I said, 99 will be crap, but the last 100th will be good.
Do you wait until you have that 100th before you present it to the team? Or is it one of the 99 that maybe someone else will say, actually, yeah, that is crazy, but what if we do this, and they iterate on your idea? Which way do you go?
So it depends on how bold I'm feeling that day. And again, I'm tossing out numbers. I don't know the specifics, but it will give you sort of a general feel for this. You know, let's say that I have 100 ideas, you know, so over the last month, I've come up with 100 ideas. There's probably a good percentage of them, 80, 90% that I will rule out on my own, because I'll just look at them and be like, I'm embarrassed to even talk about this with other people. And then there's the last 10 or 20% where I'm like, well, I don't know. Let's present those, right? So it's definitely not one in 100. I do come up with, you know, these ideas, and we talk about them as a team. And again, obviously other people bring their ideas as well. So I know they also filter themselves, but I don't want them to filter themselves 100%. I want them to bring even the ideas that they're like, maybe, I don't know. And we'll discuss those together, right? If they only came to me with ideas that they are absolutely 100% sure will work, like, I don't think anybody will ever come up with any ideas that they are 100% sure they will work.
Well, I guess it kind of stops you from thinking about or being comfortable with failure if you're only coming up with things that you definitely think will work. Then you're definitely not putting forward stuff that you're okay about failing with.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So you mentioned as well about brainstorming. So do you think brainstorming is ever really helpful in this scenario of trying to come up with a revolutionary idea?
On your own, yes. And so I just want to differentiate something you said, because you're making a good point. I was referring more to the, I've seen this at companies where it's like, let's get 20 people into a room and brainstorm new ideas. Like, those I feel are artificial and unproductive. me personally as an individual, yes, I do try to set aside some time each day to think about new ideas. Even and we're not talking a huge amount of time. We're literally talking like 5 minutes, where I will sit down and I will just think of new ideas. So deliberate brainstorming time, I think, is important. But I do think that initial brainstorming time is a solo activity, not a team activity. You go to the team later on when you have ideas to review. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And how do you measure the quality of your ideas and decide which ones to take?
I mean, the first test is just the common sense test, right? It's you looking at it and being like, oh, that's just not going to work. then getting into a team. And what we like to do as a team is basically write out each idea, you know, come up with, you know, people come up with the reasons why it will work. And I want to emphasize that because I don't want people to come up with the reasons why it won't work, right? It's very easy to shoot ideas down. And again, I'm not looking to be risk-free. I am looking to take risks. So I want people to write down ideas for why this will work. And based on, you know, what we see on the board, we pick some ideas to experiment with, and then we take them to the next stage where we might build a mock-up or a presentation. I guess it all depends on what the idea is, and start circulating it with other people to see what the response is like.
How much time do you have to reserve for this then? Not for the idea generation, but for the exploration?
It depends. So with my current team, I don't do this with all my directs. I have too many directs to do this as a big team, right? So I do this, you know, once a month with a smaller group, and I may do it multiple times a month with different groups. But it's not that much. It's 1 to 2 hours a month. Yeah. Once a year, when we get down to the actual sort of roadmap creation, then we might spend a whole day on this. But on an ongoing basis, not that much. A couple of hours a month at the most.
And then how much capacity from the development team do you reserve towards these experiments? Or is that just dependent on where you are, if you have an urgent need or not?
So it depends on the company, right? When I was at a smaller company, and this was a startup, much more risk tolerant, we literally had what we called a free code Friday, where every other Friday the devs were, you know, and the PMs had to pitch their ideas to the devs, and the devs would be free to take up whichever one of these ideas they wanted. And at the end of the day, we see how far we got. Now, I'm at a bigger company right now, you know, public, we have bigger customers, and so we have to be a little bit more risk tolerant. So these days we actually try to reserve capacity. We have a, you know, 5 to 10% capacity reserved for some of these ideas, but we have to compete for that capacity with the engineers who want to use some of this capacity for refactoring and fixing stuff. So we have to be a lot more measured in our approach, which is why we try to be a lot more experimental before we even get to the development stage. We come up with mock-ups and ways in which we can judge whether this idea is worth it before we ask the developers to write any bit of code.
And in your talk, you say something about how this process is similar to Star Wars, but with zombies.
But listen, you look at every movie these days, right? If you look at Hollywood these days, most movies are not that original, right? They're sequels or spinoffs. You know, young adult became a trend. Okay, well, then immediately 20 other young adult movies come out, right? It's because Hollywood doesn't like risks, right? They don't like big revolutionary things. They like knowing that they will invest X amount of money and get X amount of money back. And so typically Hollywood writers, when they try to explain revolutionary ideas to people, they try to put it in a sort of risk-free way. It's Star Wars, but with zombies, right? It's like, if you tell me that, it's like, oh yeah, I get it, Star Wars, but some of these people are zombies. Now, you may not mean that at all. You're probably, you know, pitching something totally different. But in my mind, the producer, I'm like, oh yeah, that sounds very doable, right? You basically understood, you explained a very complex topic to me by using that metaphor. And in fact, we use that for startups too. Again, I was joking about it before, the Uber for garden equipment. Now, that's actually a really bad explanation, because if I tell you the Uber for garden equipment, what you took out of that is probably very different than what I'm planning. But notice how you didn't ask questions, right? He's like, oh, yeah, the Uber for garden equipment. I get that. Mm-hmm. Uber was known in garden equipment. Well, I know what that is. So I totally get how you would create an Uber for garden equipment. It's just a way of explaining ideas that sort of both helps with the ideation stage, but it also helps explain them to your investors. And as a product manager, you definitely have to think about your investors.
Yeah. And do you think anyone can do idea generation, or do you think it's you have to be a certain type of person? So a kind of more, I guess, more creative or more knowledgeable or what do you think?
I think anybody can do it. Anybody can do it if they practice. Again, it has to be an intentional practice. It's like any other skill. The more you spend practicing it, the more you will become better at it. I actually think knowledge sometimes is a bad thing, right? Because knowledge helps you shoot down your ideas by saying, oh, that's never going to work. And so I'm not sure if knowledge is always good. Sometimes it's actually nice to have people who are not knowledgeable come up with some ideas and then sort of run them through the same filter. But yeah, I absolutely think anybody can do it. It's a muscle. And if you exercise that muscle, it will become stronger.
God, the balance between knowledge and confidence in this must be complicated.
What do you mean?
Knowledge can be a barrier to generating or sharing ideas, but then the confidence to share them. So you can come up with a really goofy idea and have way too much confidence in it, or you can come up with a great idea but have no confidence in it.
That's absolutely true. Yes, I do agree with that. And knowledge can help you with the confidence either way, though, right? So you might a lack of knowledge can make you too confident, and too much knowledge can make you too confident, mm-hmm. right? So you have to watch it both ways. But yeah, I do agree in general.
I generally think that's why a lot of product people don't become founders, because they're too good at like going and finding out all the information, all the reasons why they shouldn't build something and invalidating their idea.
No, and if you look at most successful startups, they pivot multiple times, right? So as a startup founder, I have to have that incredibly confident attitude to say, it's okay, this idea will work. And literally 3 months later, when you were proven wrong, you have to tell yourself, it's okay, my next idea will work, right? And that's amazingly difficult, right? My hat's off to all those successful founders who've pivoted multiple times, because just think about how terribly hard that must be to absolutely be 100% sure that your idea will work to the level of I will take other people's money and my own time and money and invest it in it. And then 6 months later, when that idea miserably fails, you're just like, yes, but my next idea will definitely work, right? Like that's got to be horribly tough.
I guess it's, you know, with in that sort of scenario as well, it's all about execution, isn't it? It's not really about the idea.
Correct. Well, listen, there are some ideas which are just bad, right? I mean, but yes, I think in many cases it is about the execution. And by the way, so that's a part where, as much as I admire startup founders for their confidence, in many cases they don't focus as much on the execution when they really should. So I think that there's the problem with overconfidence. Agreed.
We all like to focus on the novel and the new and the thing that makes us, that proves that we are unique and special and come up with some special genius. How do you know when it's right to just copy instead of focusing on the revolutionary?
So it depends on what you're trying to do. And notice that in many of my methodologies, I am copying, right? The Star Wars with zombies, it is a copy play. It's just, it's a question of how you present it, right? And let's take an example from today's market, right? We've got Tesla. I mean, Tesla are held up as innovators, right? Amazing innovators. But listen, there were electric cars before Tesla. There were luxury cars before Tesla. There were battery-operated cars before Tesla. None of these ideas is particularly revolutionary. They just merged all three. And so there's a question, and I think this goes back to something that we talked about before, which is, are there ever truly any original ideas, or are there just some ideas that are seen as original? I don't know the answer to that. What I do know is that you don't have to be 100% creative to be perceived as being creative. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I answered your question, though. I think I went off on a tangent there for a minute.
That's all right. I can think of, I've got a former life as a music journalist, and any number of people who are hailed as absolutely brilliant originals will gladly tell you about all the people you've never heard of that were their influences.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, very relevant comparison.
Maybe that's the key to being perceived as innovative, is you got to have influencers who are unknown. If your influencers are too well known, then everybody is aware of the fact that you're being influenced.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess that was the hint at the kind of the knowledge bit that I was asking about earlier. If you do your research, or if you just know like lots of different things that are going on, then you have a pool of resources to use in order to generate new ideas from lots of other stuff that you know about.
Oh, so let me be clear. Maybe I misunderstood that earlier, but I think you're 100% spot on there. And in fact, I think that's a really important point to make, which is I try to make sure that my product manager is, I'll give you an example, right? The company I work at right now, I said, is in the insurance business. Like, I don't want people who have lived their entire career in insurance, because to me, that narrows the scope of their knowledge, right? I want people who've worked in gaming, and I want people who have worked in entertainment and banking and all of these other fields and disciplines. And I want my product managers, I sent one to a gamification conference, and I sent another to a conference about the latest e-commerce technology. I think you're 100% spot on. The more of these knowledge bases you have, the easier it is for you to say, I just saw this really cool thing that they do in financials. How could I apply that to my industry, right? If all you have is your industry, your ideas are not going to be that revolutionary.
Yeah.
I met a guy a couple of years ago who was working in trade floor technology, and he was looking for some engineers to help him out. And he, instead of recruiting people from financial institutions, because they were, as they went up there, the ladder, they would say, I'm the expert in this, but I'm only the expert in outbound. I've never touched inbound and things like that. Instead, he recruited some, I think it was Xbox engineers, because the people who are most passionate about latency were gamers.
Yep.
And he found absolutely the right people to help leapfrog the competition in his field.
That's exactly right. And I mean, listen, at the end of the day, I'm not saying people shouldn't specialize. There is value in specialization, but there is also problems with specialization. We become very locked into these worlds, and it prevents us from borrowing ideas from outside of these worlds.
Who are your favorite innovators or idea generators in the world?
So, I'll go the counter the grain here. And rather than telling you somebody in tech, my favorite innovators are actually in entertainment. I love innovative entertainment products that are unlike other things. And those typically don't come from the big studios, right? They either come from the young producers who still are willing to take risks, or they come from the small companies who, again, are happy to take these risks. And it's, by the way, it's fascinating to chart the progress of, let's say, a producer who starts out with all these cool innovations, and 5-6 years into their career is doing nothing but sequel after sequel, because they're big enough where they don't tolerate risk. Mm. It's easy to tolerate risk when you don't have a big career. When you are a well-known producer or director, it's all of a sudden it becomes not so okay to have a big flop on your resume. And so you'll see them becoming more and more risk averse. I love my innovative movies and comedies and such. My favorite right now is The Good Place, if anybody's seen it, if I can make a plug for it. Because this is where you get the truly innovative stuff, right? The Good Place, like, think about that. Like, they're back to the sitcom, but they've also married it with a serial plot, which I find fascinating. And the whole methodology for delivering the story is novel and new. But again, I think if you look at those producers 5 years from now, if The Good Place becomes a hit, they will be taking less and less risks.
Well, I'm going to go further on that one. The only reason they got to make The Good Place is because it's the people who made Parks and Rec in the U.S. office. So they already had this massive track record, and that's what got them the freedom to do this. But if you want to learn more about how The Good Place works, They have a fantastic podcast themselves where they talk about every episode and how they create the environment where people are allowed to take risks and contribute and really make a concerted effort to creating an environment. But it goes back really nicely to what you said at the beginning. You need to create the environment. You've got to be free to fail. But the other corollary to this is sometimes you have to succeed to create the confidence around you.
That's right. In order to get the bigger budget.
Gal, I don't have any other questions. That was absolutely fantastic. Lily, did you have anything else you wanted to cover? Or Gal, did you have anything you wanted to do that we missed?
I'm okay on my side. I mean, listen, if you guys put my name on the podcast, I will say I'm not that hard to find. There's literally only one Gal Josephsberg in the world. And so it's easy to find. And I always love talking about these things. So I really enjoyed the conversation. I look forward to future conversation. And if anybody has questions, send them my way.
Thank you so much, Gal.
So we're back. Looking forward to another year of podcasts, Lily?
Yes, and what a fun way to kick off the new year. We've got so many great guests already lined up, so make sure you subscribe and never miss an episode.
You know, that could be a really easy New Year's resolution that you can actually keep. So definitely do it.
The Product Experience is part of the Mind the Product Network. Our hosts are me, that's Lily Smith, and Randy Silva.
Emily Tate is our producer and Luke Smith is our editor. Emily is ours alone, but we're happy to share Luke if you need someone to edit your own podcast.
Hey, you can't share him too much. He's my husband. Our theme music is from Hamburg-based band Pau, that's PAU. Thanks to Arne Kittler, who runs Product Tank and MTP Engage in Hamburg and plays bass in the band, for letting us use the music.
And sign up for your local Product Tank, a regular meetup in over 185 cities worldwide. There's probably one someone near you. And if there's not, you can start one yourself. To find out more, go to mindtheproduct.com/producttank. Here's Global Coordinator Mark Abraham to tell you more about it.
Product Tank is a global community of meetups in over 155 cities across the world, driven by and for product managers. Whether you have a group discussion or you're listening to speakers, the whole idea is to create a safe environment for product people to come together and to share their learnings and tips.